You're listening to a Rhino.com podcast. Yes, you are.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of the RhinoCast. We have a great show for you today. We're going to start things off with an interview with Peruvian singer Cecilia Noel of Cecilia Noel and the Wild Clams. They will be performing soon at a cultural event at the Skirball Center, so stay tuned for that. Then up next, we're going to have an interview with legendary Monkees singer, songwriter, and guitarist Michael Nesmith. Be sure to go to monkees.com for the full unedited version of this interview. We're going to give you a nice taste of it here, though, on the RhinoCast. And then we'll finish things up with the man, the myth, the legend, Bob Lefsetz, and the Lefsetz letter. So stay tuned.
Melinda Newman, contributor to the Los Angeles Times, Washington Post, and Associated Press, and we're just listening to Ocotario from Cecilia Noel and the Wild Clams. The band will bring its mix of salsa and soul to the Skirball Cultural Center in Los Angeles on Thursday as part of the Skirball's free Sunset Concert Series. The show is at 8 p.m. I'm delighted to be here with the band's leader, Cecilia Noel. Thank you for joining us. How are you doing today, Cecilia?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Now, you call your music Sal Soul.
What's that mean?
It seems to me like it's more than just the blending of salsa and soul. There's a lot of other stuff in there.
Sure, it is. But soul meaning also it comes from the soul, from your spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not only related to soul music, but the fact that it's mixed with everything that is very passionate.
So there's a lot of sensuality going up there on stage. I've seen some of your videos, and this is a band that is wonderful to be heard, but is better to be seen, from what I've noticed.
I think so, too. I think that everyone enjoys the songs very much as well, but the performance is so fiery and so full of joy that people really get an incredible reaction from the shows.
You grew up in Lima, but also studied in Argentina and Germany and spent a lot of time learning different instruments and even learning to conduct. So many kids now receive absolutely no formal training, and even many musicians receive no formal training. What was the best part for you about getting a solid education in music?
Well, I was very fortunate to have a mother that was very into cultural life and making sure that we would not only just be singing like little birds, but we would know what theory and harmony and music was all about, and be very knowledgeable of what we were doing as artists, whatever we chose in the art field. Because I have a sister that was a ballerina, So, you know, it was very important for my mom that I would have a full-on education in music. And as much as I kicked and screamed when I was little, I really found the benefits of had studied when I formed the Wild Clams and started writing and arranging.
Now, by the time you were 8, you were a regular on a television series in Peru. What did that teach you about performing at such an early age?
The first thing that taught me was to be disciplined, to rehearse, because the more I rehearsed, I had less of stage fright.
It sounds like your mother always encouraged you, and in a society that doesn't necessarily encourage women, you got a lot of support. You're descended from one of the last chiefs of the Incan Empire. Your great aunt was celebrated as the Mother Teresa of Peru, and your mom was a very successful designer. How did that affect you, knowing you had all these strong women doing amazing things and supporting you?
That was enormous influence in my life, especially because my mother was, and you know, the women in my family were pioneers in you know, I don't like to call it women's liberation, but they were like the first women that wore pants in Lima, and my, although my mom was very much of an agnostic, she played organ and piano in the church when she was, you know, when she had her first six children, and was you know, very poor, and to support the kids, and you know, she took all these odd jobs, and she was, you know, working at the church as a musician, and she went there wearing blue jeans, and it was like, this was like in the 40s, so, and then 50s, you know, so it was pretty impressive, and she always led this very cultural wave in Lima, so she was very well known, and that affected all of us in the family. And it's a funny thing, but in Peru, I always feel that the women are the power of the country.
But it also sounds like it gave you wings. It gave you freedom. If you saw your mother taking these chances and making these revolutionary moves for a woman in that day, that you must have felt empowered to go forth and blaze your own path. So is that why you formed the Wild Clams? You formed them in the 90s after you'd been doing everything from appearing on Broadway to singing standards at the Rainbow Room in New York. Was that the next step for you to helm your own band?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, I had to show that I had my own voice, that I was not only a singer of standards and beautiful Brazilian songs, but that I could also write and put on paper and on sound and on record and on a stage who I was as a person, as an artist, as a South American woman, and with all the influences that I had collected through the years, you know, with James Brown and Pérez Prado and Jimi Hendrix, and you know, Sly and the Family Stone and Tower of Power, Count Basie, I mean, you name it, I had, you know, sucked up every possible record that landed in my hands, you know, but I had my own story to tell. So it was really important for me that I would sit down, focus, and start writing my own music.
Now, you remain a very rare thing in the music world, which is a female leading a large band.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been difficult for you? Have you found that there's support for you doing that, or are there people who are looking to see where's the guy who's leading the band?
No, I have been so fortunate. Because it has such a unique voice, the Wild Clams, and I write most of the music, and, you know, most of the songs, because, you know, I have, of course, collaborators and a beautiful person like Eric Jorgensen that does the orchestrations with me, you know, but the it's never been confused who leads the band, and I think that it is my project, and everyone knows that, and everyone is comfortable in that situation, which I find extraordinary and a blessing, because, you know, not a lot of musicians, you know, would necessarily, you know, respect anyone in being the leader of a band, let alone a woman. But I have never, ever found anything but support and love from the musicians and the artists that have come see the show.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
You sing in Spanish, English, Portuguese, and probably some other languages.
And Yoruba, a little bit of the Yoruba that I learned from my friends in Cuba, the group Synthesis, the fabulous Carlos Alfonso that taught him and his wife, Ellie. They taught me how to do those chants and allow me to perform Opatereo, which is it was arranged by Carlos Alfonso, and he kindly gave it to me to do with the Wild Clams. But it was just wonderful, and they taught me, you know, the chants. So, and of course, I have had the fortune to also work with Francisco Aguabella and Lazaro and Andy Garcia, that also you know, do all the Yoruba chants, and we, you know, once in a while we record together, and I get to learn more about this fantastic culture. So I love to sing in Yoruba.
Is there one language that's sexier than the other to you?
I love them all. But once in a while, you know, a little bit of the Portuguese, it's very, it soothes your mouth more than, it's like a love language. You know, although I come from a Portuguese grandfather that I never met, but I taught myself how to speak Portuguese just singing Brazilian music.
So what's the sugar dance? Will you be doing that on Thursday night?
Of course, the sugar dance. The sugar dance, I was taught to me by another Cuban friend from the group NG La Banda. And I think Los Van Van also do the sugar dance. And then a friend of mine, you know, we used to do it all the time, and then we came up with the Spanglish version of it, or the English version of it, and then we started teaching it to the crowds here, and it was just so much fun, and everyone now does the sugar dance, you know?
So people better be prepared for that.
Oh, yeah. The fans already know the sugar dance, and anyone else can join in, and it's a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for your time. We're going to close with some more of your music. Do you have a preference, or do you want us to choose something?
Oh, you can actually play Dip It if you want to do the sugar dance.
Perfect. We're going to leave you with Dip It so people can be practicing for Thursday night.
Absolutely.
Cecilia, thank you so, so much for your time, and we look forward to seeing you on Thursday.
Wonderful. I hope you all come, and we'll have a great, great fiesta.
Doing the sugar dance.
All right.
Take care. Bye.
Ciao.
Are you ready for the sugar dance?
Yeah.
Should we do the sugar dance?
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Get in the pot of honey.
Welcome to Monkeys.com and Rhino.com's interview with Michael Nesmith. This is Andrew Sandoval, and I had the pleasure of speaking with Michael about a number of current projects in his creative world, including the recently launched online virtual environment VR3D, some of his impending solo catalog CDs due out soon from Demon Records in the UK, as well as Rhino's recently issued 40th anniversary editions of the Monkeys albums in mono and stereo. So sit back and enjoy this conversation with musical innovator and video visionary Michael Nesmith.
I don't know, but don't smell like corn silk.
Our chat began with details of VR3D, an offshoot of Nesmith's VideoRanch.com website. This recently launched subscription environment allows users to develop a three-dimensional screen profile in the form of an avatar and to interact with other VR3D subscribers. Activities include live concerts with high-fidelity sound, audience interaction, and three-dimensional musicians, as well as lectures, dance nights, movies, and my favorite, of course, the ability to fly. Here's Nez.
It's a social virtual reality, social in the fact it doesn't have a game quest or any particular effort that needs to be made. You're not in competition with other players in it. You don't need to reach different levels and so forth. It's just purely for hanging out and meeting people and talking and sharing. And of course, the question is, what do you do in there? In there being in the virtual world. So a long time ago, actually in the late 90s, I started looking at ways to program different things in the world. I think a lot of different people have different ideas who run these virtual worlds. Second Life has a sort of hands-off policy. They don't provide any kind of programming in there, and they leave it all to the people who are in Second Life and build Second Life and so forth. And then there are a few other virtual worlds where there are some programs that are provided by the owners of the world and so forth. What Video Ranch started to become was like a group of venues where there could be live performances of various type, most specifically centered around music and live music performance. So the question was, how do you embed this music in there? You know, do you just play it back so music plays when you go in there with your avatar, and so I've been working on that for a long time, and about a year ago came up with some technology that allowed me to put video inside the world where it's embedded in the world in more or less a seamless way, so that it looks as if the performers are in the world with the avatars. So you can go there to the virtual world, go to the venue, which again is a virtual venue, meet your friends who are all avatars, and watch a live band or a live act perform. And that's what Video Ranch is about.
Day passes and a variety of other subscription options are available from VideoRanch.com, which is linked to our new site here, Monkeys.com. It has to be seen to be believed. Nesmith himself has DJed within the confines of VR 3D, and the inevitable question is, will we see a return to the live stage, albeit in virtual reality, from Nez himself?
Well, it's entirely possible. I don't know whether I will or not, because I just haven't been performing. I have to say that if I was going to perform, it would probably be the most interesting to me and the most appealing to me to perform in world. Because it's simple. It's a great environment for a performer. The stage at Video Ranch Studios, which is up in Northern California, is really set up for a beautiful production value, beautiful music production value. And the question is, am I through performing? And I think I may be. I don't feel too much compulsion to go back out and play much anymore.
Nesmith's most recent musical endeavor was the 12-song 2005 release, Raise.
As you know, being in the record business, it's a different world out there now. We made an initial offering of a couple of hundred signed limited edition CDs, which we sold as art pieces because I didn't really think we'd sell any in the record stores. And in fact, we haven't really sold too many in the record stores. We have a little distributor who sells hard goods, and they continue to order bits and pieces, have for the last year. But I've been very happy with the success that it's had in the digital world. We've sold a lot of downloads on the various sites, and a lot of downloads at Video Ranch. You can download it at Video Ranch too.
Nesmith fans can take solace in the news that there are new CDs on the way, at least new CDs of his older records from Demon in the UK. These all feature new liner notes and also a remix of his solo debut album, The Wichita Train Whistle Sings, which was recorded 40 years ago.
Yeah, I guess it is the 40th anniversary of the Wichita Train Whistle.
I may be the only person celebrating that anniversary, but
I may be the only person that knows it, Andrew.
But I'm happy to be waving my flag or my windmill for the American Wichita Production Company.
Yeah, good for you. That's I had forgotten it. I did it like in November. You know, when I made that record, we were really in the eye of the storm by that time, and as far as the Monkees were concerned, and I wasn't getting a lot of opportunity to make music as much as I wanted to. You know, I had always envisioned my life as an artist to be centered around the joy of daily making music, and, you know, in some form or another, performing or recording or something. And but of course, with the Monkees, it was just this monster, this maelstrom of television shows and just all the stuff that surrounds something when it gets that big, and so I didn't have an opportunity to be doing all the music I wanted to, and Wichita was a great opportunity for me to get to do that.
Another of Nesmith's hidden nuggets was recently unearthed by the Sundays label in the form of a CD by the group The Penny Arcade. Nesmith sponsored and produced recordings by the group throughout 1967 and 68.
But you know, it was really strange because I was under the impression that those guys were playings, and that I had heard them play live in L.A. around, but the guy in Germany who did the liner notes said no, they'd never played live, because you know there was a lot of really cool music going on the Strip and around L.A. that had a signature sound to it, and I thought the Penny Arcade really captured it. And when I listened to it, you know, when they sent me the master, I was so surprised to hear that sound of the L.A. streets of 1968. I mean, that's really the way it sounded when you drive down Sunset Boulevard and go by Pandora's Box and listen to those, listen to the music coming out of those clubs. It was like 6th Street in Austin in the 80s, you know. It was just a completely inundated with this music, and that's the way it sounded. I was trying to describe it to somebody the other night, and I started off one night at the inn down by the Palladium, just a little past Vine there, or whatever that place was, you know, just a little past Vine. Started there and worked my way all the way up through the end of the strip, and who I saw was Jethro Tull, the Buffalo Springfield, Linda Ronstadt, Chicago, the Byrds, and I think Clapton as kind of a I don't know, I may have him confused with somebody at that point. But anyway, that was kind of what was going on up and down the strip during that time, just in different clubs.
Nesmith recalls more happenings from 40 years ago in part two of our interview. So stay tuned to monkeys.com and rhino.com for the next installment.
Right on. That was Michael Nesmith of the Monkees. And if you were digging that, please be sure to go to monkeys.com for more of that interview. Get the full unedited version of Michael Nesmith's interview at monkeys.com.
Hey, it's Bob Lefsetz for the weekly Rhino Cast. You know that record, but why do you know that record? You know, there's a whole bunch of records like that, and Could It Be I'm Falling in Love that I knew, but I did not know why. I didn't listen to Top 40 radio that much. It's by the Spinners. Hey, we're going to do it again. Go back, Jack, do it again here on the weekly Rhino Cast. And I'm going to give you a little L.A. history, how this works. I discuss this with my girlfriend all the time. Her father was a famous guy in the music business, actually a musician himself, or she would say composer. And I try to explain to her, what's it like if you come to L.A. and you don't know anybody? It takes 2 years to figure out who's a winner and who's a loser, okay? Because everybody comes to L.A. to make it. And everybody is completely full of shit. And you don't know what's going on. I remember I had a Walkman, and the Walkman broke. And I went to get it repaired. This is before they were so cheap, you just threw them away. And there was some kind of crisis with the repair, and they brought out the repairman. And I talked to the guy. Oh, I'm a musician. I moved from Boston. Yeah, come hear my stuff. I got a girlfriend. We got an act. And I go to their house, and the stuff is kind of okay. And you're hanging out. Lord only knows where those people are today. On some level, if you have a day job that requires any intelligence, chances are you're never going to make it. Because it's too much energy. Tom Scholz on the other coast, he made it. But most people, their day jobs are incredibly stupid. Or in the later era, the hair metal era, the Guns N' Roses era, the Poison era, you know, you would have girls who would actually pay all your bills. But I'm trying, you know, I moved to L.A., I'm going to law school, I'm finally done with law school. It's like, how am I going to make it? You're always meeting people, always checking things out. Actually, I was living with this woman in law school. Finally, we broke up. And I decided to go to UCLA Extension. Unfortunately, they still give the classes. It's just not as exciting because music is not really the pulse. You would go to UCLA Extension and find all these people like yourself who were intrigued, who wanted to know what was going on. And I would go, and I would just be, I remember I took, you know, this record production course. I actually took that while I was in law school, because law school was such bullshit. But one of the key courses I took was record concert promotion, okay, with Jim Rissmiller. Jim Rissmiller was the big concert promoter of the time. This is 1981. There was a company called Wolf and Rissmiller. Wolf was murdered in his house, and no one ever really knows whether it was accidental or whether there was some kind of drug deal or something behind. To this day, we don't know. You hear it both ways. Rissmiller was devastated. Rissmiller took over the business, and he kind of had a chip on his shoulders, wrong way to put it. He wanted to prove that he didn't need Wolf. Ultimately, I think he did need Wolf, because Wolf and Rissmiller concerts went under. But he gave this course at UCLA. Very hard to get into. You had to write an essay, and I wrote an essay. There were probably about 25 people there, and there were all kinds of things. Some guys still hear from an email. You know, he played me a demo. The demo was phenomenal. Unfortunately, the other two tracks were not as good. And I started managing that act because I knew the business with this, myself and two other guys. An act that's not going to make it with three managers, you're going to starve, which ultimately, you know, I did, and I stopped doing that. But you start to meet the different people in the class, because you would go. I remember we went to a Ted Nugent show at the Sports Arena. Yes, Ted Nugent used to be able to sell out sport arenas. And it's funny, interacting with David Krebs, big manager at the time, managed, you know, AC/DC, broke Aerosmith, all kinds of big acts of the 70s. Although this was like, you know, the 80s when it's a slightly different era. But it was still David Krebs. You know, he's a good friend of mine now, but I, you know, that was like the first time I met him. Not that he would ever remember that. But you're hanging with all these people. Another guy, my friend Robert, who unfortunately is no longer with us, and it's pretty sad because about 4 years ago he took his own life. This type of thing, you know, if you ever want to do that, don't. Because whatever pain you're in, the rest of people are going to have to live with that forever. Everybody ever know. You know, when the guy was alive, one of my closest friends, I thought about him. Now I think about him every fucking day. I believe he was mentally ill. That's how I explain it to myself. Otherwise, and it's kind of an LA story. Came from a wealthy family. It wasn't like there was no money at all. But everything went wrong for him in Hollywood, and it was very tough for him to cope with. And there's a lot of stories like that. And they make movies about him, but they get him wrong. Robert had gone to law school in Denver, and he moved to L.A. to make it. And we became friends. And you start hanging out. I remember he took me to a 4th of July party way up in Malibu Hills. This is after I stayed up all night the night before listening to All Six Sides of Sandinista, lamenting the fact that I'd broken up with my previous girlfriend, the law school girlfriend. And this is a party. The guy had all these records. He had more records than I'd ever seen. And this is back before the days of MP3s, okay, when you could have as much music as you want. The guy had a hot tub. I remember taking off my clothes, getting in the hot tub. Not everybody at the party did that. And I was there with Steve Bators of the Dead Boys. He had a new act at that point. He ultimately died. But I started to hang with Robert, and Robert knew different people from me. And he knew this guy, Eric, and Eric was in a band called Fast Fontaine on Capitol Records. And Robert knew these people really well. I started to hang with them. A couple of the guys lived in a hotel, okay, on Sunset Boulevard, where the Mondrian is right now. And it's fascinating because, you know, these guys have been through all these varying bands. This guy, Eric, who always talked about colonics, he was really into this new age stuff. He had come from Oklahoma, I believe it was Oklahoma, in a different band. And this was kind of his last shot. And ultimately he gave up, and he went back to Oklahoma. I believe he's a social worker now. Okay, Fontaine Brown was the leader of the band. He inspired Bob Seger, okay? And it's from Detroit. The other couple of guys in the band, one guy, remember, he had this Fiat 128. He was getting a divorce, and they came and repossessed the car in the middle of the night. The bass player was this guy, Dan Rothschild. His father was Paul Rothschild. Paul Rothschild, in case you didn't know, legendary talent scout producer for Elektra Records. He did not only all the Tom Rush records, he did all the Doors records, except for the final one. So I start hanging with these guys. Fast Fontaine. Fontaine Brown is a really seen-it-all, charismatic, kind of slick dude. You know, he was kind of soft-spoken. You want to hang? We could kind of connect. Okay. And I remember going to the recording studio and doing, you know, varying things with them. I wasn't quite sure where my place in the landscape was. But one night they said they were going to play Magic Mountain. Magic Mountain to this day is an amusement park north of Los Angeles. And they have a performance space. I don't know if it's still there. I'd only been there once before because I'd gone to see that movie Roller Coaster with my law school girlfriend. And we went there to ride the inverted roller coaster. And I used to be scared of roller coasters. I got on that roller coaster, and all of a sudden, you see things go upside down, and you're freaking the fuck out! What the? And you can't jump off! And I remember my eyes closed involuntarily. But after you do it once, you can get very into it. And one of the great things about going that night with Fast Fontaine is if you stay there till midnight, the last hour, you can get on any ride. We rode that the Revolution, the one that goes upside down. And that's like, they still have it, but that's like, you know, a baby roller coaster compared to what they have today. We rode that like three times in a row. So I'm there. We're riding the roller coasters with Paul Rothschild. You know, I don't know if I completely even appreciated who Paul Rothschild was. He ultimately died of cancer. He smoked a lot. I think it was lung cancer. And Fast Fontaine, we're hanging with him. They're going to play this gig. That's one of the ways they try to get people in on a Friday night. They have music. There was another band. I really can't remember what the name of it is. And Fast Fontaine, I'd seen them before. They're doing their act. But then they do this song. Let's start it over. In the audience, the sun hasn't completely set, and Fontaine Brown's coming alive. He's got a cane. He's working this song. It's like unbelievable. It's not really like the rest of his material, and he didn't really introduce it. But you know, great material almost anybody can do.
Once I went to hear them play at a club outside of town. I was so surprised. I was hypnotized by the sound this cat put down. When I saw this short, fat guy stretch a band between his toes. Hey, I laughed so hard.
So the show ends, and you know, really, you don't want to talk to stars right after they come off the show, although off the stage, although I'm not quite sure if Fontaine Brown was a star at this particular time. And I had to go up to Fontaine and say, what was that record? What was that song? What was that song you played? He goes, oh, Rubber Band Man. And you know, I felt like an idiot. But all those guys from Detroit really know their soul music. He goes, the Spinners. What the fuck? I'm like the whitest guy on the planet. What the fuck do I know about the Spinners? They had most of their hits. I was living in like the whitest places known to man where they didn't even have any radio, never mind black records. I'm going to college in Vermont. I'm living in Salt Lake City. It's crazy. So I get home, and I got to, you know, I'm up in Valencia, in Magic Mountain. I got to buy a Spinners record, okay? It's very different today. There's no website. There's no MySpace site, although if you Google Fontaine Brown, you'll see he has a MySpace site. You can see what he's up to. You can say hi to him for me. And, you know, you want to hear that record. So I go to the store. There's no little Amazon to look things up, no All Music, and they have Best of the Spinners. And the stunning thing is, you know every track. Not only Mighty Love, but I'll Be Around, you know, duet with Dionne Warwick. It's unreal, but I cannot stop dropping the needle on Rubber Band Man. You know, I just can't get over it. What is the Rubber Band Man? Was there really a Rubber Band Man in Philadelphia and the song is about an actual guy? Or are these guys just so messed up on drugs that they're coming? The Rubber Band Man and he's twiggling his toes and do all this other stuff. The record is fantastic, but the lyrics are from outer space. And I love this record, you know, and I'm completely lost. I'm broke. It's like the end of 1981, beginning of 1982. And I had a special relationship with Fontaine. I decided to call him. He was living with his girlfriend somewhere in the beach, just far enough that I was on the phone for like 2.5 hours, and I got a bill for like $45. This is prior to the days cell phone call anywhere or cable call anywhere for the same price. And that was the last time I saw Fontaine until I ran into him at the Bug Music anniversary party. It was either the 10th or 15th anniversary. They moved to a building near La Brea and they had a party on the roof. And you saw these people you hadn't seen. These are two great guys, Dan and Fred Burgoyes. They are publishers. And if you don't know what a music publisher is, do a little research. They own all the songs. And they had Del Shannon songs. That's how they got started, by helping Del Shannon out prior to him committing suicide. And Fontaine was there because they published Fontaine's stuff. I think that's originally how I met Fred Burgoyes, because we went over there one day with Paul. You hang with people who are actually in the game. You meet people, although you don't know when they're going to come back in your life. It's like just today, you know, hanging out over at Guitar Center. It's like you meet all these people. Oh, yeah, yeah, I know. Lon Friend, you know, the editor of Rip. You know, you end up knowing these people, and they come back in your life. Most people fade away. So along the way, I found my own way. I actually went back to practicing law for 10 minutes until I could get another job in the movie business, because this managing bands, I was starving. And it took me a long way to find, long time to find my way, because it's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll, as AC/DC said. But whenever I hear Rubber Band Man, I think of Fontaine Brown, Fast Fontaine, and those days, and getting started here in the music business. So till next time, it's Bob Lefsetz with the Spinners and Rubber Band Man.
So much rhythm, grace, and debonair for one man, y'all. And then he had to go to twiggle his left toe, but through his knee, got a feeling in his head, y'all.
You've just listened to a Rhino.com podcast. Visit Rhino.com for music, movies, and all kinds of crazy shit.